from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Director Martin Scorsese's The Wolf of Wall Street is a wild ride of sex and strippers, cocaine and yachts and raging greed, and most of all, money. Piles of money. It's racked up 5 Oscar nominations, Best Picture, Best Lead Actor, Best Director, and more. It's also brought an unusual surge of pushback, controversy, from moviegoers or boycotters saying enough with the Hollywood cautionary tales that actually glamorize a rapacious Wall Street culture. It's easy to guess what Leonardo DiCaprio's money-mad character Jordan Belfort would say.
If anyone here thinks I'm superficial or materialistic, go get a job at McDonald's, because that's where you belong.
Okay, but what do you say? This hour on Point, the debate over The Wolf of Wall Street. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Have you seen it? What did you think? Does the wolf take on the worst of Wall Street's ways or glamorize them? Can you do both? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We will hear in this hour from a prosecutor who was in the thick of the real story behind The Wolf of Wall Street, and from a former hedge fund trader who walked away from what he now calls wealth addiction. It's really kind of about Hollywood and Wall Street and how it plays. Here's the sort of moment in that long arc. Gordon Gekko, played by Michael Douglas, his famous line from the original 1987 Wall Street movie.
Greed, for lack of a better word, is good. Greed is right. Greed works. Greed clarifies, cuts through, and captures the essence of the evolutionary spirit. Greed, in all of its forms, greed for life, for money, for love, knowledge, has marked the upward surge of mankind, and greed, you mark my words, will not only save Teldar Paper, but that other malfunctioning corporation called the USA.
Greed is good, says Gordon Gekko, Michael Douglas in 1987. Update to right now. Hear from The Wolf of Wall Street in a speech to his brokers. Jordan Belfort, played by Leonardo DiCaprio, tells them what life will be like if they choose not to work with him for the big, big money.
Before you depart this room full of winners, I want you to take a good look at the person next to you. Go on. Because sometime in the not-so-distant future, you're going to be pulling up to a red light and you beat up old, you know? And that person's going to be pulling up right alongside you in that brand new Porsche with that beautiful wife by their side who's got big voluptuous And who are you going to be sitting next to? Some disgusting wildebeest with 3 days of razor stubble and a sleeveless muumuu crammed in next to you and a carload full of groceries from the Price Club. That's who you're going to be sitting next to.
Don't choose that, says Jordan Belfort, played by Leonardo DiCaprio there. And it is interesting how much controversy there has been around this film. Got a lot of interesting folks to talk to today, but first of all, from New York, David Edelstein, film critic for the New York Magazine and NPR's Fresh Air. He also contributes to CBS Sunday Morning. David Edelstein, welcome back to On Point. Wonderful to have you here.
Thank you very much.
This was not your favorite film. There are people calling it bold and beautiful and wonderful. There are others saying this is a, you know, yet another kind of big suck-up to Wall Street, whatever it intended. You call it insipid. What's your problem with the film, David?
It's a hard one to kind of graph, although, of course, that is my job, to graph my own responses.
Yeah.
I want to part company somewhat from the moralists insofar as I don't think art has any obligation, an artist has any obligation to give you a sermon. In fact, what killed when we were listening to Gordon Gekko, that was such a beautiful distillation of Ayn Rand and a lot of others. The Gordon Gekko, unfortunately, as we know, really ended up becoming the hero of that movie and inspiring an entire generation of traders and of, you know, young capitalists. And I don't think that there's any mystery why, because who is the other father in Wall Street? It's a tedious, moralizing, lefty union man played by Martin Sheen. We don't remember that character. All we remember is Gordon Gekko. And I think that Scorsese made a correct decision not to load up The Wolf of Wall Street with all sorts of tedious moralizing. At the same time, he makes no moral judgments whatsoever. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, I do. Mm-hmm.
He says, I'm going to make a concert film. It's really sort of like his Rolling Stones film when you think about it. I'm going to celebrate the energy of this guy. I'm going to celebrate the materialism. I'm going to show the most beautiful women, the craziest drugs. I'm going to make it so excessive that on one level it's repulsive, but on another level, what would the alternative be in this country? It would be to work at McDonald's. It would be to ride the subways alongside, as he says in one scene, minorities. There's really no distance in the film between Scorsese and his protagonist, played by Leonardo DiCaprio. It's almost as if it's a party movie. And it does bring out the moralist in us, but it also brings out the humanist. Some of the objections are really more humanist. Every time you see a character in this movie, you know exactly who he or she is going to be at the end of the movie. First shot, it's everything you need to know.
Yeah.
Every scene makes the same point over and over again. It's this incredibly curdled vision of humankind that Scorsese is pushing that really, in its way, is as cheap and curdled as its protagonist.
I mean, I wonder about no moral judgment at all. He's got DiCaprio, you know, snorting coke off a hooker's rear end, or, you know, DiCaprio and Moore rolling around so high on Quaaludes that they're practically strangling themselves and choking to death. That looks like a kind of, hey guys, you're going too far depiction.
It does, except that Scorsese worships a kind of masculine energy, energy for its own sake. In Scorsese's universe, there's really nothing worse than passivity or impotence. And so even this man, as horrible as he is, the film creates the kind of climate in which you're like the character in Woody Allen's in one of Woody Allen's movies, on the train with the sort of the nerds and the losers, looking at the party train going by full of all the beautiful people, and you're thinking, I really want to be part of that. It's true that there are certain scenes that make you say yes and no at the same time. Yes, I want to be there. No, it looks absolutely horrible. These people are horrible. And yet I think Scorsese wants you to like them anyway, because the alternative in this country is too horrible to contemplate.
I mean, that depiction in itself of that kind of just two sides and nothing in between. You're either kind of a rich, rapacious Wall Street, in this case, scammer, or you're working at McDonald's. I mean, people throw up their hands and say, wait a minute. Don't we want a country where there's a lot of rich territory between those two, even though with all the inequality and the big divide, you know, maybe he's right. There's something like that. But people push back and say, no, thank you.
Well, I think you put your finger there on a couple of things. Number one, it is a reductive movie. It is a movie that says it is either this or that and can't seem to imagine any kind of middle ground. The other thing is that from a political standpoint, if this shames a good portion of the country, or inflames and angers another good portion of the country, that's fine, too. I mean, politically, I don't mind that at all. There was a wonderful op-ed in the New York Times the other day from the point of view of a trader who talked about greed in terms of, in very Scorsese-like terms, as an addiction. It loses any sort of specific meaning, and it just becomes acquisition. It becomes fighting against tax hikes. It becomes loosening of regulations. It's just this crazed addiction, more, 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 more. That's a very Scorsese-like view. I actually thought that the piece itself made a lot of the same points that the movie did, only far more succinctly and wittily, I thought.
We're going to hear from exactly that hedge trader who wrote in the Times, Sam Polk, before this hour is out. So stick with us, David. Here's that Scorsese speech in the mouth of DiCaprio from The Wolf of Wall Street saying, you've got to be rich.
Let me tell you something. There is no nobility in poverty. I have been a rich man and I have been a poor man, and I choose rich every time. Because at least as a rich man, when I have to face my problems, I show up in the back of a limo wearing a $2,000 suit and a $40,000 gold watch.
Okay, so there from The Wolf of Wall Street. What surprised me about this, David, was back in the days of Wall Street, Gordon Gekko, and the first time around, Greed is Good, there were people who shook their heads, certainly, and there was plenty of controversy about Wall Street. We had our crash in the 80s and all the rest. But I don't remember the thread of controversy that I've seen out there about this one. I've heard debates between 20-somethings, you know, one who's bound and determined to go and see it, another who says it's wrong even to go and support that kind of view of the world. Enough of that. We don't want to see that anymore. Stop it, Hollywood. Stop it. I don't remember that response in the past, David.
Well, that's good, I think, because really great art ought to be dangerous. I mean, let's not forget Scorsese made Taxi Driver, right?
Yeah.
You know, which was based on... Well, it was based on Paul Schrader, the great screenwriter, based it on Arthur Bremer, who shot Wallace. And then Taxi Driver, in turn, inspired a new generation of assassins,
yeah.
Sadly. So I think that in that regard, I think it's great that it's caused all sorts of debates.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the debate over The Wolf of Wall Street, nominated now for 5 Academy Awards. We're asking, does Hollywood always end up glamorizing the Wall Street world it sets out to expose? Or was that even Scorsese's goal in this case? David Edelstein is with us, film critic for New York Magazine and NPR's Fresh Air. Here from the beginning of The Wolf of Wall Street, Jordan Belfort, played by Leonardo DiCaprio, is taken to lunch by mentor Mark Hanna, played by Matthew McConaughey. In this scene, Hanna shows Belfort the ropes.
What can I bring for you on this glorious afternoon?
Well, Hector, here's the game plan. You're going to bring us 2 absolute martinis. You know how I like them, straight up. And then precisely 7.5 minutes after that, you're going to bring us 2 more. Then 2 more after that, every 5 minutes until one of us passes out.
Excellent strategy, sir.
I'm good with water for now, though. Thank you.
It's his first day on Wall Street. Give him time.
Give him time. McConaughey's character instructs DiCaprio's in the sex he'll need to keep going, the drugs he'll need to keep going, and then a little kind of strange and wonderful ritual. My favorite moment of the show.
You know what a fugazi is?
Oh, fugazi. It's a fake.
Hey, fugazi, fugazi. It's a wazi, it's a woozy, it's a
fairy dust.
Yeah.
Come on, and off they go with their chest thumping. What exactly was that, David? Some kind of call to war, arms, something.
What it was a call to coolness, mm-hmm. is what it was.
Yeah,
because,
yeah.
You know, it's Matthew McConaughey, one of the great weirdos in modern show business, creates this wonderfully charismatic character. Let's face it, ever since the beginning of film, probably the beginning of literature, the villains have always been more appealing in some ways than the heroes.
Yeah.
They're always cooler. There was this hue and cry in the 30s that we were glamorizing gangsters when we made movies like Scarface, like the old Scarface. And in fact, there were cries that we were glamorizing gangsters when Brian De Palma made the new Scarface. In fact, there were a lot of people out there who were really worried about the impact of a movie like De Palma's Scarface on Latinos, on African Americans, on, you know, the underclass who are going to see this movie and want to imitate this guy. And as I said before, art is dangerous. There is a degree to which that's a valid worry. And there's also we also have to say that in some ways that does not matter because art is all the best art is going to get under your skin. The best art is going to make you want to identify very, very profoundly with its subjects, in extremis. Now, but there's something else at work. Mm. Much of what we respond to in a work of art is also the distance between the artist and the subject. And I would argue that in Taxi Driver, we were infected by Travis Bickle's insanity, but we could also stand back from it. The characters in the film were rich enough and were not reductive that we could stand back and see him in the context of his society and say, wait a minute, this guy is really screwed up. And the same thing was true to a degree of Scorsese's Goodfellas. What I think is missing here is this entire film, The Wolf of Wall Street, did you notice it seemed like it was set in a vacuum? You never saw any of the consequences of what these guys were doing. They were cheating people left and right, but you never saw any of those people. There were no ramifications. It's a very tiny movie in some ways, blown up to 3 hours, because it takes place on this tiny level of reality in which we neither go above it or below it.
But it's provoked pushback. Christina McDowell had this open letter addressed to Scorsese and DiCaprio in LA Weekly. This was back in December. Ended up going to the web and getting attention all over the place. Her father, she reminded them, was arrested and eventually sent to prison in the whole scandal around Stratton Oakmont, the brokerage firm where all this fraud had gone on. And she goes right at, ultimately, Scorsese and DiCaprio. This has been picked up and shared all over the world. She wrote to them, among many other things. She says, so here's the deal. You people, that's DiCaprio and Scorsese, you people are dangerous. Your film is a reckless attempt at continuing to pretend that these sorts of schemes are entertaining, even as the country is reeling from yet another round of Wall Street scandals. We want to get lost in what? These phony financiers fund sexcapades and coke binges? Come on, we know the truth. This kind of behavior brought America to its knees. This letter has been picked up and embraced by many. It's been mocked by others, but it's really got people talking this time. It's fascinating. Phil in New Orleans is calling. Phil, you're on the air. What do you think?
Well, my entire party and I were wondering why we didn't walk out of the movie. We all asked that question.
It was 3 hours just because it was too long, Phil, or what?
Well, no, because it was pretty disgusting. The celebration of the greed, which is endemic in our society. Even in the most mundane ways, you see greed manifest. Just watch people drive. Hey, you get in traffic. Watch people, how people drive. That's another form of the greed that this movie, in its financial way, celebrates.
Scorsese's trying to lay it out in front of you so you can say, wow, that's just too much. Or maybe he's just an artist saying, America, see thyself.
Well, you know, true, the greatest subject in art is death, you know, in painting or literature.
Or a pile of cocaine.
It's not a pile of cocaine.
Exactly. But you wondered why you didn't walk out. Phil, I appreciate your call from New Orleans. One more right here from Mashpee, Massachusetts. Barbara. Barbara, you're on.
Hi there.
Hi. What do you think?
Well, you know, I've spent my life on Wall Street. I'm a partner in a large firm. And one of the things that resonates with me, I did see the film, it really isn't Wall Street. It's a tiny fringe element that could be selling fenced auto parts. This is the underbelly of Wall Street. This is not the normal commerce of Wall Street, which is, you know, capital formation and buying and selling and trading equities. These are guys that are truly the sleaziest elements that are capitalizing on innocent, naive people, really, that are looking to make a fortune buying penny stocks. So, yes, I agree with your with David, mm-hmm. who said that they really don't. They never touch upon the victim. But this is not Wall Street. This is not the bulk of Wall Street.
Well, Barbara, I don't want to split hairs, and I get what you're saying. That's a particular thing. It was a pump and dump. They start off in a former auto body garage. This is not buttoned up Wall Street, that's for sure. On the other hand, and with respect, because, yeah, capital formation, great. But we saw the titans of Wall Street kind of go around the bend with all the derivatives that made so much trouble. And now we're looking at the biggest banks on Wall Street, J.P. Morgan. They just made a $13 billion settlement with the U.S. government. That's not for nothing, Barbara. And we have also read the stories about the coke and wild sex and strippers that weren't just on the fringes of Wall Street, but kind of right down there in the heart of the gullies.
I disagree with that. I do believe, yes, there's been a lot of, as they say, when Lehman Brothers went down, Dick Fuld didn't really want to hear from a CFO that continued to tell him that there was a lot of trouble.
Yeah.
And I say that the psychology is that you don't want to listen to someone when you're making gobs of money.
Yeah.
But I do think that the cocaine, the sex, the drugs, rock and roll, and limos is completely overhyped, and it has more to do with that element of Wall Street, which is the pump and dump boiler rooms.
Barbara, we'll take some reassurance in that, and surely Hollywood was having fun with that. I guess that's part of the issue here. David Edelstein, stand by. Joel Cohen joins us right now, former assistant U.S. attorney in Brooklyn, New York. He led the criminal investigation of Jordan Belfort in the 1990s, the character played by Leonardo DiCaprio in Scorsese's film The Wolf of Wall Street. He's currently a partner at Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher. Joel Cohen in New York, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, have you seen the film? What did you think of it?
I did see it. I can say I didn't enjoy it, but unlike Mr. Edelstein, I'm not a movie critic. My personal view is just my view. I had some.
You know a lot more than I do, I should say.
Well, maybe that's true. I don't know, but I did have serious problems with the depiction in the movie.
Why?
Putting aside the artistry of the film and what one thinks of it, whether you enjoy it or not.
Yeah.
And even accepting for a moment what DiCaprio and Scorsese and Terrence Winter, the screenwriter, have said was their purpose, which is to put the audience in the shoes of victims, which I did not experience when I watched it, but perhaps others did.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a certain obligation to be true to the facts, especially if you're going to purport to tell a story that you say is true, and you're going to purport to say teaches us broader lessons about society.
What did they miss?
They perverted the truth in certain ways, two specific ways that really bothered me. First, the very last scene in the movie, and there's no spoiler alert necessary here because this will not ruin it for anyone who hasn't seen it. The very last scene depicts DiCaprio playing Belfort years later after having been released from jail, after having cooperated with us in our case.
A very cushy jail as depicted in the film.
Well, which, you know, I don't think that was accurate
okay.
either, but
mm-hmm.
in any event, that's Hollywood for you.
Mm-hmm.
But the last scene, Mr. DiCaprio is playing Belfort. He's in front of a large audience giving a motivational speech. And who did the filmmakers decide to introduce the fictional movie version of Belfort, but the real Jordan Belfort? And what did they decide to do but put the real Jordan Belfort's real current motivational speaking company poster behind them in the movie so that hundreds of millions of people or tens of millions of people who see this movie can basically see a free advertisement.
So he's still making out. What about the victims? I mean, you dealt with these guys. You dealt with the real Belfort and more. What about their victims? Describe them to us. They don't show up much in the film The Wolf of Wall Street.
Well, I don't show up at all in The Wolf of Wall Street, and I think the filmmakers would agree with that, or at least have explained that. They varied widely, but some were wealthy, some were not wealthy, some lost a portion of their life savings, some lost virtually all of their life savings. All of them were utterly ripped off in the sense that unless you were an insider working with Belfort and his cronies, at the end of these transactions, you would lose virtually your entire investment. That was the way they designed it. They did 34 or 35 initial public offerings. Every single one of them was rigged specifically to make the investments by third-party innocent investors lose almost everything and to enrich the close friends and family of Belfort and his friends. I mean, it was as clear and simple as that.
You say, you write in a piece in the Times Deal book, you write, as scheming as Mr. Belfort is depicted on screen by DiCaprio, it's hard to feel the proper degree of disgust for one charmingly portrayed by Mr. DiCaprio. What do you mean?
Well, part of it is a compliment to Mr. DiCaprio. He is an incredibly charming and enigmatic actor. He could play almost anyone, and you would like him. And I can't hold that against him. But part of it is the way they wrote the screenplay. For instance, there's a depiction of Belfort as being stand up. This is a classic sort of Scorsese maneuver. You know, he likes the idea of even people who commit crimes sort of stand close together and protect each other. The sort of omerta of the mob.
Mm-hmm.
And he added a fictional element of that into the Jordan Belfort story. Now, the reality is that Jordan Belfort and his partner Dan Porsche, who's played by Jonah Hill, when we arrested them, raced to the courthouse to cooperate with me and the FBI agent investigating the case.
No omerta there. Top speed.
No, and you know, and that worked well for us because we were able to make use of them undercover for about 9 months and built some very strong cases that helped the government and helped the public. But that's the reality. That's not a reality that fit with the seemingly neutral view that the filmmakers want to pretend now they were showing. But the reality is they wanted these guys to look good. I mean, this, if they didn't want them to look good and they just wanted to tell the true story, why not tell that part of it too? Well, I think you can guess the answer. It's because it's not as attractive to have a protagonist who doesn't care about anybody.
And there's the crux of it from the guy who was right at the heart of the prosecution, Jill Cohen, former assistant U.S. attorney in Brooklyn, now at Gibson, Dunn and Crutcher. Jill Cohen, thank you very much for taking a minute to join us today. Just terrific to have you.
Thank you.
With us now, Isaac Chotiner, senior editor at The New Republic, covers arts and culture and politics. He wrote an article about the movie, its headline, the Silly Liberal Attacks on the Wolf of Wall Street. Really terrific piece. Isaac Chotiner, welcome to On Point. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
What's the heart of your critique of the silly liberal critique, as you have it?
Well, what I was trying to argue in my piece is that I thought the movie was trying to do several things. The first of which, as David pointed out, was it was trying to show this story from the point of view of Jordan Belfort. And I thought it accomplished that quite well. And the second thing that I thought the movie was trying to do was to tell us that, and I don't want to spoil the movie for people who haven't seen it, but that this is an unreliable narrator. There are several things in the movie where we see them and then we're sort of reminded in the way the movie's told that what we're seeing is not actually going on. And so the realism of it, which I think in a broader sense, it's trying to depict something, doesn't extend every specific event. And I think we're supposed to take everything we see with a certain grain of salt. So those two things were sort of why I felt that some of the attacks on the movie had gone too far. But more broadly, to go back to some things David said, I just don't think you can hold artists responsible for how people misinterpret their work. And so, you know, Oliver Stone wrote this movie in 1987, Wall Street, which was clearly meant to be a critique of capitalism. And a bunch of people on Wall Street thought, actually, this is a celebration of
right,
us.
It's great.
I don't think you can. Yeah, exactly. And I don't think you can blame Oliver Stone for that. Oliver Stone, which David also mentioned, wrote the movie Scarface, which Brian De Palma made, which he clearly meant as a critique of capitalism as well. And people took that as a celebration of drug dealing. You know, and you can go back in history, you can look at George Orwell, who wrote 1984, which he meant as a critique of Stalin, and it was used as a critique of the Labor Party, which Orwell supported. You can go back and, you know, is that Orwell's fault? I don't really think so.
I mean, just stick with DiCaprio. There he was in The Great Gatsby, F. Scott Fitzgerald, classic, and I didn't see people going after it, though, in many ways. It was a rather similar story. On the other hand, can't you feel, Isaac, a kind of fed-up quality with this merger of glamour and disgust around Wall Street?
Well, I think it's reasonable that people are fed up with a lot of what's been going on Wall Street. I absolutely don't want to argue with that. I did think that the critique that you read from the woman who, her father had been involved at the company that DiCaprio runs, she seemed to be arguing slightly that sex and drugs is why Wall Street crashed. And I don't really think that that's true. I mean, it's not just that the events in the movie were depicted 10 years before the crash.
Yeah, but fair enough. Hey, Isaac, hold the thought. We got to take a short break here. Music from The Great Gatsby right behind us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking about the debate over the Wolf of Wall Street, asking, does Hollywood always end up glamorizing the Wall Street world it sets out to expose, if that's the right word, in the case of Martin Scorsese's The Wolf of Wall Street? David Edelstein is with us, film critic for New York Magazine and NPR's Fresh Air. Isaac Chotiner is here, senior editor at The New Republic. His article there, The Silly Liberal Attacks on the Wolf of Wall Street. Here's DiCaprio, just last week on NPR's Morning Edition, talked about the intentions behind the movie.
It's the exploration of greed in a lot of ways, and to me, it's the most destructive force in our modern era, and it's going to continue to be so.
Exploration of greed, but ooh, it's a party. Here's Martin Scorsese, director, also up for an Oscar, in an interview with the United Kingdom's Daily Mail, explaining how he decided to illustrate the story of Jordan Belfort in The Wolf of Wall Street.
It's a story about something that's dark in all of us. Mm-hmm. If we had the ability to behave certain ways with absolute power, and what would happen. So that's something I've always been fascinated by, and I wanted to handle it as frankly as possible, so that it wouldn't be a matter of making comments on him and his bad behavior, but actually putting the audience into the mindset of that behavior and that mentality.
It's Frank, all right. Strippers and hookers and coke and lewds and you name it. And of course, Jordan Belfort, one more time, played by DiCaprio, his view of the world.
Now, if anyone here thinks I'm superficial or materialistic, go get a job at McDonald's, because that's where you belong.
Ouch, from The Wolf of Wall Street. We're going to hear in a moment from Sam Polk, a former hedge fund trader who said he became a wealth addict. And maybe that's at work here. Loring in Somerville, Massachusetts. Loring, thanks for calling. You're on the air. What do you think?
Hi, Tom. I think we could be interesting to compare Scorsese's Casino with The Wolf of Wall Street, because Casino had the mob occupying Las Vegas. And here in Wolf of Wall Street, we see the greedsters with their narcissistic personality disorders occupying Wall Street. Now, I've been a salesman. I've also had good friends on Wall Street. I know these things went on. And after all, the movie is based on a book. But it was interesting to see DiCaprio, because I've just seen him in Gatsby.
Yeah.
And Wolf of Wall Street is sort of the Great Gatsby on steroids.
Yeah.
And because it attracts the women and
sure.
So forth. You have this viewpoint. Now, the problem is, what does it mean to be a human being? What does it mean to be what's valuable? And if we put value on material goods and we get into a habitual pattern with that and an addiction, we're in deep trouble. And I think this is what Scorsese was up to.
Getting at in The Wolf of Wall Street. Loring, you're breaking up a little bit on us, but we've got, this, what is happiness, the life, liberty, pursuit of happiness? Is it a tall pile of cocaine on a hooker's hind end, or is it something else? I mean, Isaac, you went after this sort of silly liberal reaction here, but do you understand it? Do you understand why some people may just be slapping their forehead and saying, enough with this conflation of glamour and ripoff here? We need some new cultural models to gaze upon.
I don't know. I mean, I can't speak about the cocaine and the hookers, but I would certainly say that I thought it was a mature decision of Scorsese to sort of show the audience why people are attracted to these things. And we can sit here and we can say drugs are not at all fun and wild sex is not at all fun and bad behavior is not at all fun.
Oh, it's fun. It's fun, I suppose. Yeah.
But these things do appeal to people, and I think Scorsese is trying to show why they appeal to people. And I do also think that you should not do cocaine and you should not, have wild parties with strippers. These are not the ways to find eternal happiness in life. But let's not pretend that they don't appeal to people, because if they didn't appeal to people, then we wouldn't have any problem with drugs or unprotected sex or any other social problem.
I mean, I didn't hear the dissent from this movie as so much a kind of Kerry Nation going after the cocaine for its own sake, the sex or in all its abundance or the rest, but rather the off-screen consequences of this behavior that seemed not really to make much of an appearance. It's all Lamborghinis and coke, and where's the downside? We saw it, just a handful of years ago when the whole economy fell apart, and a lot of people really paid for that. Maybe that's driving it, Isaac.
Well, you didn't see a lot of that in Margin Call either, and yet you still felt a strong sort of artistic presence on the part of the director saying, this is ghastly what we're seeing.
Yeah,
we're seeing
true.
Something so frightening and horrible. We're not seeing the direct consequences of it, but we see what it's doing to these people. Whereas it seems to me the characters in Wolf of Wall Street are all ciphers. Isaac said, talked about the movie having an unreliable narrator. I don't know that I agree with that. It certainly has a crazy, exuberant, gonzo narrator. But is he unreliable?
Well, he is
sometimes. Travis Bickle.
Yeah, I mean, you see the story changing, you know, what was the car wrecked or not, that kind of thing.
Well, what he thinks about his wife, about the Duchess of Bay Ridge, in the first moment he sees her, is the exact truth. He sees it the last moment she flounces away. There's no tension between the way he views her as this prize object and the way Scorsese views her. And the way, in fact, we view her and in the way that the part is written. There's a lot of, you know, and in the end, you just wonder what is going on behind this movie. And the more I thought about it, the more I thought, well, here's this guy, Scorsese. He grows up an altar boy. You know, his movies deal very directly with Catholic guilt. And at a certain point, he comes into this movie and he says, I'm going to make a movie. I'm going to throw away the Catholic guilt. It's like Huck Finn saying, well, I'll go to hell. And so he leaves that 100% out of the picture. And I don't know whether I would want it to be 100% there or 100% out. Let's try for something maybe in the middle.
Yeah, well, yeah.
David knows a lot more about movies than I do. I'm not a film critic. And I think if you read his original review of the movie, a lot of his critiques were taking issue with it as a movie and saying there was no distance between the filmmaker and DiCaprio and the filmmaker and the protagonist, the narrator. And I think these are all fair critiques of the movie. I don't happen to agree with them, but they seem completely legitimate to me as critiques.
Thank you.
What I was objecting to more was the idea that this artistic choice that Scorsese made, which David doesn't like, which, again, is totally fair, that this artistic choice is by definition immoral. And that's where I would draw the line. I think that you can think that the choice doesn't work for a three-hour-long, very exhausting movie. I thought wonderful movie, but still very exhausting. But I still think it's a legitimate choice for an artist to make without being criticized on sort of right and wrong terms.
Well, it's legitimate. It's legitimate. Is it interesting?
Yeah, is
it necessarily interesting? I wouldn't do it on moral. I wouldn't criticize the movie necessarily on moral grounds, though. I just don't know that there's really enough there to sustain a three-hour movie.
And you've got people saying enough. Let's hear from our listeners. Christopher, Murfreesboro, Tennessee. Christopher, what do you think?
My wife and I saw the movie, and the way that I see it is that, and I haven't heard anyone say this yet, is that I feel that Scorsese did to us what Jordan was doing to his quote-unquote clients.
His investors, you mean, get them all excited and then rip them off? How? What?
He's sort of selling as though it's blue-chip stocks. You know, you think about Scorsese, you think DiCaprio, you think Terrence Winter, you think of all of the big-name people that are in there.
Screenwriter, yeah.
What you expect from them. And then he really delivers. He doesn't deliver. He doesn't deliver what you expect it to be.
Well, what do you mean he doesn't deliver? I mean, there's some incredibly compelling scenes, but what, he doesn't deliver the depth you want or the social critique you want?
Well, you know, with Scorsese, and even with DiCaprio, too, he really attaches himself oftentimes to projects that have some very thorough storytelling, you know?
Yep.
I think the rigor that you would expect from Scorsese is not there.
Just not there.
Not you see it in the other movies.
Yep.
It's just not there. And not only that, but I felt bad because I was complicit in that my wife and I were looking at Showtimes trying to figure out what to see, and that sort of fit our time slot, and my wife was like, you know, I don't really want to see just a bunch of drugs and hookers. And I'm like, well, I'm sure they're just selling that on the preview, and there's going to be more to it when you watch the movie. Yeah, you're probably right. We get in, and sure enough, I guess
maybe not. Christopher, I appreciate your call. One more. Forgive me, I've got a couple I've got to get to. Richard here is calling from Brazil, no less. Paraty, Brazil. Richard, what did you think?
Hi, my problem with the movie as a whole was its complete misogyny. In other words, it makes misogyny very common. Obviously, most of the women in the film are hookers, but even with the wife, the woman is an object. And if you see Europe, it for sure as hell isn't about sex. If you see good European movies or good American movies where there's any kind of something warm going on between a heterosexual couple, It has nothing resembling this movie.
But is that Scorsese's fault, Richard? Maybe that's, you know, that stripper hooker culture around the edges. Maybe that's what there was.
No. Listen, he chose to make that movie, and I object to the fact that he made that movie.
I mean, an artist has to go, but you're not alone in wondering about it. Let me get, if I may, get Sam Polk in here. Wrote a piece that turned a lot of heads in the New York Times last week, an essay. He's a former hedge fund trader who left Wall Street, started a nonprofit called Grocery Ships. We'll talk about that. His piece talked about wealth addiction and how he himself, with $3.5 million in bonuses at a very young age, not so long ago, was a victim of it. Joins us from Venice, California. Sam Polk, thanks for being here.
Hi, thanks a lot for having me.
You wrote about wealth addiction. You found it on Wall Street. What is it?
Well, I can tell you about my experience with it, and I want to bring it into a context of what everybody else is saying. And first, I want to thank David for his kind words about me. And I have a subtle difference with what his perspective is, and I think it's important. So I published this piece in the Times on Sunday, and the response has been absolutely overwhelming. It's still the number one Twittered article on tweeted article on the New York Times.
Yeah, you describe how you became a giant fireball of greed. 40,000 bonus wasn't enough, and then a million wasn't enough, and then you wanted a billion, and you said there's a sickness here. Did you find it in The Wolf of Wall Street?
I absolutely did, although the key difference between my piece and The Wolf of Wall Street is that the majority of the response that I've gotten from people is identification. They really say, I really identify with that struggle that was happening inside me. And The Wolf of Wall Street is slightly different. I believe that from the beginning, they portray Jordan Belfort as a really despicable guy. And so it allows the audience to, you know, really judge this guy for being not a nice guy while sort of celebrating the drugs and the sex and all that. And that's a really safe position for us to be in. But the reason that I thought that my piece really hit a vein in our culture is because I was actually showing how we're actually grappling with this within ourselves. And, you know, one of the groups of people that I've heard a lot from is college students. And they write and they say, look, you know, I'm about to graduate from Dartmouth or Yale, and I have this chance to go to Wall Street, and I have this chance to, and the woman earlier made a
and make the big
point.
Money. Mm-hmm, yeah.
The woman said that The Wolf of Wall Street was different than Wall Street. And that's true. Like, you know, these kids at Dartmouth have a chance to go to Goldman Sachs and get a lot of prestige and get a lot of power, but at the same time, they know that they want to do something good for the world. And it's that really, that real conflict that I think that we all really struggle with, that The Wolf of Wall Street allows us to sort of sidestep. Because we can just point our fingers at this guy for being greedy and, I very much agree, very misogynistic, and all that's terrible. But really, what are these kids from Dartmouth supposed to do when the truth of America right now is that there's two Americas? There's the rich, wealthy America, where you can go to Goldman Sachs and make $2 million a year. And then there's the 99% of the world that can't make anything.
Well, I mean, surely it's not Goldman Sachs or McDonald's, quite as stark as that for your Dartmouth and Yale guys, and hopefully a lot of others. But you write, you say about this wealth addiction, you say wealth addicts are more than anybody specifically responsible for the ever-widening rift that is tearing apart our once great country. Don't you think Scorsese's kind of making that point here? I mean, his Jordan Belfort couldn't give a hoot for anybody else, couldn't give a rip.
That's true. He definitely has the same thing that so many Wall Street guys do. The thing that the sort of difference in how I see it is that, you know, even on Margin Call, which sort of gave a more realistic demonstration of that greed, they were still doing things that were illegal. But the actual fact is that on Wall Street and in politics, all of the wealth addiction is perfectly legal. And not only is it legal, it's incredibly celebrated. right? Every time a billionaire makes another billion, we put them on CNBC, and we put them on Bloomberg Magazine and all these things. And that's the real heart of the issue, whereas that, like, Jordan Belfort is off the grid. He is like a guy, he's a marginal guy doing clearly criminal things. But the thing that most people are struggling with is that greed is so, and wealth addiction is so ingrained in our culture that it's actually really celebrated. And so the truth is that you have all of these guys in the top 1% making more and more money, and there's nothing to stop them because the more money they make, the more celebrated they are.
Sam Polk was there as a hedge fund trader. Now he's founder and executive director of Grocery Ships. It's a nonprofit. It helps low-income families gain access to healthy food. Isaac, what do you think? Do we ever stop making these Wall Street kind of movies with this tension between the glamour and the greed? Is that a perpetual American formula for box office?
Well, this movie's doing pretty well, and Great Gatsby did pretty well, too. Mm-hmm. I just want to go back to one thing that he said, which is that, you know, one of the interesting things about this movie, and I think one way in which the filmmakers are maybe trying to make the movie seem slightly more relevant than it is that, you know, we did experience this horrible Wall Street crash several years ago, but the stuff that's being depicted in this movie is the sort of thing that could have been depicted any point in human history. I mean, you have young, greedy, sex-obsessed men, and you have them not running complicated derivative schemes, but something more akin to like a pyramid scheme or just outright fraud.
Yeah, fair enough, though it can echo pretty loud and clear these days after what we've just been through. Boy, I wish we had more time. We do not. Isaac Chautner, senior editor at The New Republic, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks.
Sam Polk at Grocery Ships, good luck to you in your new venture, your nonprofit. Sam, thanks for being with us.
Thanks a lot.
And David Edelstein, film critic for New York Magazine. Wonderful to have you as always, David. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.